This piece was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 126 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sarah Kamen.
In studio today, James Beard award-winning chef and author Gabrielle Hamilton. She's just published her first cookbook, aptly named after her East Village restaurant, Prune. We'll talk to her after the break. Later in the show, we'll put Chef Hamilton to the most insignificant yet fun test of her life, the Morning After quiz. But first, some food news with Sarah Kamen. And Chef Hamilton, please, you know, interject if you'd like to, if you have opinions about our stupid food news.
Speaking of insignificant, yet the most fun of all time. Okay, starting off, we all remember Pastis in the Meatpacking District, RIP Pastis, closed last February. Now confirmed, Pastis, the former location, is turning into a restoration hardware. Oh, just...
I seriously think they're going to put a cheesecake factory across the street.
Well, they might be. I mean, I think that mall. The Meatpacking District is going to be like the new Disney. I don't know. It's like Epcot, New York. And so another thing that makes it, I don't know, I guess like adding salt to a wound or whatever that phrase is, they are apparently going to be selling wine on the upstairs of the restoration hardware. And I also want to point out that earlier this year, Urban Outfitters opened a restaurant in their Williamsburg location. So I just feel like it's going to be, if you want to go eat or drink, you're going to have to like go shopping or something first. Like, what is happening to restaurants?
I mean, I will say often when shopping, I become very hungry and very angry. So maybe they're like saving a lot of couple fights.
I will say when I shop, it makes me want to drink, but it doesn't necessarily go the other way. Well, I guess if it was a restoration hardware, I'm never like, oh, I'm drinking. Oh, my God, I would love a doorknob right now. But I can definitely see how it would be the other way around.
You know, but I think that often when you drink, that's the moment you're like, oh, we have to get this done. Yeah, let's get this done.
And you, it like, is the moment where you're like, maybe I can afford that antique dresser. That's
100%. That's gonna happen.
That
yeah.
is smart. That
and you're
is
like,
smart.
Oh, I've really been meaning to change my kitchen cabinet knobs.
Yeah,
finally,
you like have to go through the store to like go upstairs and drink wine, and then you're like, oh, I did notice that little like chaise lounge on the way up.
Chef, any thoughts about restoration hardware?
About selling furniture in Prune?
No,
not at all.
She's just shaking her head. I mean, I think Prune's doing okay.
I think they're okay. Moving on. Just gives me more reason to never go to the Meatpacking District.
No, don't go there.
Okay. So this is kind of great. There's a writer for The New Yorker. Her name is Patricia Marks. And she was doing a story about animals who are considered ESA, which is emotional support animals, not just service animals. There's a distinction. And if you have some sort of disorder, and particularly, I guess, an anxiety disorder, you really need to have this animal around all the time for your comfort. So she went and applied for an ESA credential, which I guess entitled her to bring animals wherever she goes in order to support her disorder. So she was doing this undercover story on it. And this is all, I mean, this is all fake. She doesn't actually have a disorder. But she took a turkey with her to Cat's Deli's, which I guess was fine.
I mean...
Then... this is amazing. She took an alpaca to a drugstore.
And this was like
after,
a llama, right?
Yeah.
Like a llama.
Yeah. And this was after taking the animal on a train from Hudson to Niagara Falls. And then this is kind of like the tipper. She took a pig to the Four Seasons. And I guess it was all good. I mean, if you have this card, you can dine with your turkey friend or your alpaca friend.
We had that experience the other day, but we were told that you're not allowed to ask for the card.
Oh. Because it would give too much anxiety to the person.
No, because you can't single out and ID the person with their disorder. So they can say to you, I'm bringing my dog in.
But dogs are different because service dogs are different.
But this was a small, like Lhasa or a...
oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Like a Snuggles.
Like a guinea pig.
I don't feel good. I want a Snuggles.
Like a guinea pig.
I want a lhasa apso.
So it's interesting.
Yeah, and I guess there is like some contention between the health department.
That's what we were worried about.
Right, yeah.
Like, okay,
it's
well,
like, so
we
which
need
one trumps
to honor
which one?
You, mm-hmm. but we also don't want to get in some big trouble. So we didn't know what to do, but...
Can you only imagine if the health department walks in, they see a dog there. There's no way they're going to pay attention to those.
Be like, oh, you can't, I feel ID bad. You have anxiety.
No, they're going to say, oh, well, you're shut down.
Yeah, exactly. So it's an issue. But just to give you a sense of how many people are applying for these, in 2011, 2,400 people applied or registered their animals. And this last year, 11,000 animals were registered. So I don't know. It's becoming a little bit of a phenomenon.
I would like to see an alpaca in New York City.
I would love that. I mean, really anywhere. It doesn't have to be at the restaurant.
How do you tame the alpaca?
They seem tame.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What if it just starts galloping while on a leash?
How do you know what they want to eat?
I think they
How
just
do you order
spit,
for your
right? I have no idea. They just like some hay.
There is a picture of the turkey sitting in a chair at Katz's, which I recommend you Google. Okay. And then lastly, the restaurant Park Avenue Autumn, the restaurant that changes its theme according to the seasons, could be Park Avenue Winter or Spring, depending on the time of year. They have the city's
They
most...
should have like deer fly season.
Oh God, I don't even
Hurricane season.
Hurricane season.
Yes. Ugh. All seasons.
Yeah. They have a really intense fall cocktail. It was created by their head bartender, and it's a squash cocktail served in an entire delicata squash that has been carved out. And then so they have this like huge squash that's been carved out, the cocktail comes inside, and then that squash is served in a glass on the rocks. And I just want to ask you, chef, you're so resourceful, you use everything in the restaurant, there's no waste. I can't decide if that's like wasteful or resourceful.
Oh, I would do that if I had the real estate. It's too bad the tables at Prune are so small, but if you could put a whole pumpkin on it,
it feels kind of silly.
And just so
like,
say,
it depends. Are they using all pumpkin just for the purpose of the cocktail, or is it like they have these leftover squash hollows?
Yeah, I wonder how long the squash carcass lasts.
Yeah, because can you really reuse a squash?
Well, alcohol is a preservative, right?
Good point. So if it's a boozy drink, they're set.
Yeah.
I mean, it also like, sit, you know how long those gourds can just sit on your counter? You know, you're
right.
Like, it's January and you're like, oh, the fall gourds are still here. Maybe that's what they're from. They're from last year.
I don't know.
In fact, aren't they water carrying objects in Africa?
I guess.
I don't know.
Yeah. Or alcohol, whatever works.
So then when their summer season comes up, it's going to be a dried out gourd for
I wonder what they're going to do for cicada season.
Run.
We're going to take a break.
You are listening to Piece of Your Pie by Snowmine.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Savera Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back here on The Morning After. With restaurants opening and closing in New York City at almost the speed of light, Prune Restaurant in the East Village has managed to stay current, exciting, and on top for the last 15 years. Chef owner Gabrielle Hamilton won a James Beard Award in 2011 for Best Chef in New York City. Her memoir, Blood, Bones, and Butter, is a New York Times bestseller, and now she has just published Prune, the cookbook. Chef Hamilton, welcome to The Morning After.
Thanks for having me.
So right out the gate, I want to know, did you always plan to write a cookbook for Prune?
No. I was offered some cookbooks to write a cookbook in the very beginning in 99, maybe 2000 in there when we opened, and that didn't make any sense to me at all because we hadn't done anything yet and I didn't even know if we would make it, and I didn't know you could have a book deal right away, having not even proven yourself. So I postponed any kind of book story. And then, in 2011, I wrote the memoir. And that was a long time coming. And by the time that came out, what do I want to say? The memoir started out as maybe the idea was lively essays about food, and it turned into a memoir. And people had said, oh, are you going to put recipes in there too? And I thought, well, I don't really want to succeed just by having added the recipe. I wanted to fail or succeed on the terms of the memoir and not have added bonus material just in case the writing sucked of the memoir. So I thought, okay,
it
no recipes. And then after that book came out and was received very nicely, I got a little panicked about sophomore effort and writing a second book, and I knew that people would be poised maybe to hate it. Mm. And also I knew that my barrel was dry and empty. I had exhausted all that material. And in the intervening years, we have been, in fact, asked 1,001 times for recipes. So we get asked a billion times for recipes. And I thought, okay, well, why don't we just kill a couple birds with one stone? I'm going to give you all the recipes.
All the recipes.
And I'm going to circumvent the sophomore effort fear. And I'll just have the second book be a, you know, cheerful, easy recipe book. How hard can it be, I thought, to put some recipes on the page and put a pretty picture and a lively headnote and call it a day. And then that's not what happened. Of course, I ate my plate of crow. I realized that I take all books seriously and I revere books. And just because it's a cookbook does not mean it's to be cast off. And it turns out I don't have a mercenary chromosome in my entire makeup. So I had to really dig in and give it everything I have. So this is now all recipes and no memoir. So it's
exactly that. Like, looking at it, I feel like I've been given the best employee handbook ever, because it is, it's just your little anecdotes, your little notes that you would be saying to your staff. Things like, please take care, or something along the lines. I guess I really liked what you said about arrange attractively. Or, notes like, even for mirepoix, prep vegetables that you would want to eat so you don't have brown, ratty crap going into the pot.
Yeah, the book is written completely to the cooks at Prune, to the line cooks. And they, because I started to write the book in the first, few minutes with the home cook as the intended reader. And within really 10 minutes, I realized that I was lying and nothing I was saying was true, because I don't spend the bulk of my day or life in a home kitchen talking to home cooks. I talk to line cooks all day long. But it turns out that the line cooks I have are probably equal to the range of home cooks. So there's a novice home cook, and that's probably the equivalent of my staging extern from cooking school. And then there are very advanced home cooks, and they have sous vide machines in their own homes and stainless steel kitchen counters, and they are probably superior to me and my cook. So I think the home cook will, the novice home cook will look at this book and think, oh, I could do that. And the experienced home cook will probably read this book and think, oh, I can do that better than she can. And they probably will. But the language is all written just to the cooks. And, you know, I'm here to look out for my cooks all the time. So I'm trying to give them as much information as I can, not only about how to make the dish, but how to not hurt themselves or how to not fatigue themselves too early and how to keep your mood going. And, you know, I'm trying to preserve their shelf life and their morale. So
yeah,
I hope that's helpful for the home cook as well. I think it will be.
I'm a home cook. So just, I guess, a note on like the aesthetic of this cookbook, although it isn't written specifically to me or other home cooks, there is some things just so endearing because it feels so worn and weathered.
It is, you know, I'm kind of lying when I'm saying I didn't think about the home cook.
I know
who's going to consume the book. And so it's meant to be very...
Right. You know your audience. But there's something very deliberate just in the design that the pages feel as though your oil-slicked thumbs have passed through it, because there are wine droplets and you know, little stains all over the book that they're not actual stains, but they're photographed to feel like they are.
But they are actual. It's true. It's you know, everything is contrived, including even this in a tiny way. It's this strange thing where you want to tell the essential truth and you kind of have to bend the truth to tell the real truth. So mm-hmm. What we did is, what my idea and plan was, is to take our binder that we work out of and practically Xerox it and give it to you. Okay, but I didn't really Xerox the binder. I had to translate that into an art-directed book that would give you the essential truth of that. So yes, there are, you know, when we open the binder at work, there are the greasy thumbprints of the cook, and somebody spilled chocolate because you laid the recipe down on the counter. And we do use masking tape and Sharpie constantly to do multiples or divisions of the quantities of the recipes. But in the end, what I loved about keeping all that thumbprint and splatter stain, et cetera, is it reminded me very much of the books, this kind of family heirloom that maybe your grandmother might have given to your mother as a wedding present, where mm-hmm. she curated recipes. I mean, I don't know if this is still germane to your generation, but in my... I'm old, so yes, for us that's a real thing.
No, and it feels like a gift.
That's a gift
because
that's
of that,
right.
And it feels all of a sudden like it's not just such a precious thing. It feels like an intimate thing that, you know, you can actually cook from, and you don't have to be scared like if something.
And it's a very personal story. Mm-hmm. It's obviously I'm not trained. I have, you know, a lot of experience, but it would be foolish for me to write a book that says this is the right way. That's not the book. This is merely a true rendition of, this is what we do at Prune, and this is what you can do too if you want the Bloody Mary the way we make it, if you want the vinaigrette the way we make it, if you want the sweetbreads the way we make them. You know, I'm sure someone like Danielle would have a very different take on how to properly cook sweetbreads, but I'm just offering to you what we do, which I think is the same thing that your grandmother did. And she tore the recipe out of what, Good Housekeeping or Woman's Day magazine, and tucked it into her book. And then she crossed out half of it and told you that actually I never use as much salt as they recommend, or I don't like this ingredient, put this one instead. And so it's that kind of personal, edited, curated, and annotated book.
Speaking of like mothers and grandmothers, is the garbage section something you learned from your family growing up? Because I've never, first of all, seen a garbage section, and I worked in many restaurants, and I know they put a lot of things to waste. Because where did that come from?
Well, yeah, I grew up in a household that my mother was extremely frugal and had to feed a family of seven on an artist kind of mercurial paycheck. And she herself had wartime, you know, French parents. So, we use a lot of nubs and tips and ends and cut around the bruised part. And if it's a little wilted, it's still perfectly good. And I run a business, a restaurant, which is, maybe you know or don't know, but we don't make money. You just got to find money by not throwing shit away. So, Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, what we call, quote unquote, perfectly good material still left in what, those onion tops or the zucchini tops or the Parmesan rinds, things, egg whites, don't throw it away. I can at least make family meal out of it if I can't find something even profitable out of it. So, yeah, I'm not a fan of throwing crap away. Somebody had to grow it, pick it, kill it, pack it, wash it, get it to us. I spent all day prepping it. Why would you throw away part of it? It doesn't make any sense to me. It offends me.
what do you feel like is kind of the most genius garbage thing that you've discovered?
It's going to be hard for me to say genius in my own.
Okay.
like what do I like here?
You're proud of being this resourceful.
Happily surprised, I guess.
Happily surprised at what you can
well,
do.
Well, right. It's not like I invented anything. There's a broth that starts with water. That first we braise octopus in the water and season. Then we use that water, now seasoned with octopus deliciousness, to braise pork roast for maiale tonnato, for a cold braised pork with tuna sauce. Then, unbelievably, I save that and use it again when we have when we run this dish with periwinkles and chorizo. And
that sounds like the best fucking broth.
You know, it's like that cassoulet in the town that's been cooking for 100 years and they never change it. You just keep adding things to it and it gets better and better. And, you know, why throw it out when it just gets more delicious in the third month?
I love how you wrote about it, though. Like, you anticipated that people were like, wait, use it again? Like, you were already sort of like on the defense. You're like, you're not going to believe me, but then we use it again.
Incredibly.
Yeah. I really like the sardine spines in the garbage section. That sounds so funny to say. But I love how you use, you know, a part of the sardine that would probably normally get thrown out. And then you write, do not sell these. They are just a cook's treat and to be used as a special wax for good friends and the right people. So that's, you know, just an example. I guess I would have never imagined that, you know, a part that normally people waste would actually, like, become so elevated that they're almost like a VIP snack.
Oh, that's funny. I mean, they have to be the right VIP. And I think to say VIP at Prune says a lot about that human. So that's, we are definitely not going to send fried sardine spines to, you know, sort of the famous one-time visiting Prune actress who probably doesn't want to eat at all and is on a diet, but to the chefs that eat at Prune who are going to love that little snack, that's who we send that to.
Yeah.
So you have to sort of be selective about who's going to get that. That's a common thing in Spain after you bone out all the sardines.
Yeah.
I want to just
take a step back before we talk more about the cookbook. After Blood, Bones, and Butter came out, which was so personal and so evocative, how did things change at Prune? Did you suddenly have guests come in who felt like they had, I don't want to say entitled, but like, you know, they had kind of just gone on this journey with you. Did people treat you differently, or did they reference things in your personal life more? Did they have more questions about you personally than the food?
Yeah, I think I would say that my 5-minute tableside standard chef owner practice grew exponentially longer. So now it took the conversations tableside now take about 25 minutes and I can't get done in 5 minutes. But it's not an entitlement. I think they are entitled. I offered it. And for me, it's actually been quite pleasant because the conversations now, what's that phrase? They take the elevator to the essential in about 11 seconds flat and we don't dick around with too much food talk or
do people ever ask you really personal questions?
They do.
How do you handle that?
I answer them if I'm feeling it. Mm. And it's a funny phenomenon, but people actually tell me more things than they ask me. I think there's something about the book that's an invitation. I think a lot of people, I found themselves in the book, which was obviously the point. I didn't want to write a let me tell you another story about me kind of book, because that's very masturbatory and tedious and it doesn't contribute in any way. I wanted to write kind of a bigger book that would have some, you know, meaning to illuminate the human condition, or I don't know, just to help out a little bit. So, in fact, that must have happened because a lot of people want to tell me about how their lives are. So I don't have to answer so much. I get to hear a lot.
I want to know, while being a chef owner, putting out this cookbook, being a mother, how do you find time to write? Because I know that's what you are. That's what you love to do. Part of what you love to do.
Yeah, I don't find time to write. You have to make it. I'm always in need of a deadline. I would never wake up every morning and start writing because I felt I deserved it, or I would just carve that kind of time out for myself. That's not going to happen. So I usually have to have a signed contract, and usually the check is already in the bank so that I make sure that I meet my deadlines. And then you cram it in wherever you cram everything in. It's not easy, and it costs a lot psychically, and it hurts me and my children and my restaurant and the book, and everybody gets hurt in equal parts, and then you turn around and take care of everything again. And so I have to find the way to make these things that I'm in love with making, books and children and food and restaurants and part. I like to throw the party. I like to write books, and I love my children. And I have to figure out how to do that without, you know, getting blisters on my eyeballs, or being profoundly undernourished and not eating and not sleeping and having to drink too much alcohol. And I have to find a way to make that happen. But maybe next year I'll figure that out.
It's good to have goals.
You got to pay. You got to pay to play, I guess, is how it works for now. It's just I don't want to sit around. You know, I'm just not going to get to that today, or then your life is over. So,
yeah. With Prune being in its 15th year, you in May changed the menu. Where did that come from? What was that a part of looking through the cookbook, or how did you come to deciding to change the menu?
There's a funny mistaken idea going out into the universe now, as if the menu at Prune had never changed in 15 years.
I couldn't
have a cookbook that has 250 recipes in it. And at that, we had to jettison another 250 if we'd been cooking the same menu at Prune for the past 15 years. But what I think it has been understood is that, yes, we have always kept certain signature dishes on throughout mm-hmm. the history of the restaurant. So it makes people think that because those are gone, that the menu has changed for the first time in its lifetime. But that's not true. But what happened is that I wrote the cookbook. It coincidentally came out almost to the day of Prune's 15th anniversary, which I had no idea was happening. But as I took care of all these recipes, this long history of what we had cooked at Prune over the past 15 years, and documented them and archived them and put them in their beautiful little package, I felt like they were neatly and safely taken care of, that they weren't going to evaporate into the universe and disappear, or I would forget, or did we ever run this thing? And so I knew they had a perfect home. And it freed me to move on. I mean, also by writing these recipes down, documenting them, putting them in this book, I came to realize that I'm not the same cook that I was in 1999. I have 15 years more experience, and I've traveled more. I've been cooking more. I've been in other people's kitchens more. I have a clearer sense of who I am and who I am not. So it was time to cook new food and not be hemmed in by what I had done for the past 15 years.
Speaking of the restaurant being open for 15 years, most New York restaurants don't stay open for that long.
No, I know. It's like 184 years in restaurants.
It's like now more than dog years.
Dog years, yeah. Surface dog years.
and then restaurants that have stayed open that long have often had makeovers or image changes. How do you think Prune has stayed so true to itself without trying to keep up with any particular trends and just being itself and staying on trend at the same time?
Well, I am really glad that when I started Prune, that I didn't, I wasn't into a trend or trying to follow a momentary idea. I'm myself attracted to kind of classic, enduring, traditional things. So that has always been the outlook and point of view of the restaurant, to stay classic. And then I have a personality, I have a voice, I have a thumbprint. I put my own voice into the song, but I didn't invent the love song, you know, or the idiom. I just work within it. So I've never had to chase any trend. I think the hardest part has been actually to not chase the trend and to not feel inadequate or irrelevant if I'm not following whatever's happening now. But it turns out that classic things endure, and you don't have to keep up with what the new thing is, because you know the new thing is not going to be the same thing in a year. And people will always want to eat recognizable food at a price they can afford in an atmosphere where they feel well served by pretty girls in pink t-shirts, it turns out.
People will still wait up to 2 hours to have brunch.
Well, yeah, I'm grateful for that.
How did that animal get started? With all the choices in New York. It's amazing.
Well, actually, if you... hear the, there were not that many choices in 1999. So brunch is a new thing. I just heard the other day that I guess it's all over. People hate brunch. So I'm not, you know, I don't read the media of my industry. I'm a terrible lapsed chef.
Oh, I guess I should have announced that.
But somebody, I was having, you know, I'm in the PR moment of my book. So I met a journalist who said, well, you know, everyone hates brunch. I was like, wait, really? They do? I'm having just done 246 covers at brunch yesterday.
I disagree.
Well, they still like it here. But anyway, it had been... you know, the kind of thing where you go hungover after the band the night before and you show up at 2 o'clock and there was a place that we used to go to on Avenue A or B, and literally, like, you would see a cook smoking in the kitchen, and the eggs were all cooked on griddles and with that spray Vegeline oleo stuff, and sometimes potatoes came already peeled in cryovac bags. So for me to start brunch when we did was to kind of go against that. And I happen to love brunch and what it meant for me, because I never get to go to it. So the times that I would go to brunch, I was like, oh my God, this is a lazy ass day. After this, I get to read or go to sleep, you know? So it was a luxury. And to put eggs in the pan and to grate your own potato and peel your own potato and source your ingredients and use real technique and do the Saltner omelet. this felt very proud to me. And I have a pretty long history of late night short order egg cooking in my youth. And so it felt great to bring all that hustle also to Prune and put it in. You know, this book, this Prune cookbook, is almost like the recipe companion book to Blood, Bones, and Butter, the memoir. Because, of course, you're going to have the whole brunch section in this book, in the cookbook. And if you read the memoir, you know that I worked at Jake's in Northampton to get through college. Or, you know, if you know about the canned sardines, that's what I ate as a starving 16-year-old when I moved to New York, et cetera. So there's a lot of total coalescing between these two books.
Yeah, it reads like that, too.
Gabrielle, thank you so much for stopping by The Morning After. We'll take a break here. We'll come back with The Morning After quiz.
You are listening to Hologram by Snowmine.
This is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
And we're back here on The Morning After. We've been talking with Gabrielle Hamilton, chef, owner of Prune Restaurant in the East Village. She's just put out a cookbook entitled Prune. It's amazing. Check it out. Chef Hamilton, are you ready for the most insignificant test of your life that matters not at all? However, I will say no one has gotten all three multiple choice questions for the Morning After quiz correct yet.
No pressure.
No pressure at all. Don't worry, it hasn't been running that long. So Chef Hamilton, you share your last name with one of our founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton. He is the topic of today's Morning After quiz. Remember, this does not matter in life. Question one. Alexander Hamilton's year of birth is much disputed among historians. Some believe it was 1755, others 1757. Why all the birth year drama? Is it A, because he was born out of wedlock, his mother never documented his birth date? Is it B, people were total ageists back in the 1700s? Or was it C, he didn't want his college classmates knowing his age, so they would think he was a child prodigy?
Wow. I'm going to go with A.
A. While actually born out of wedlock, that is not the reason historians think that his birth year is so disputed. It's actually because he probably wanted to enter school older and appear to be a child prodigy. That's kind of summarizing his life, okay? But that's what I got from it. All right. Question two. When you are dropping Hamiltons, what U.S. currency are you spending?
Oh, the $10 bill, I hope.
Yes, A, the $10 bill. Well done. I didn't even have to get into that. Okay, all right.
Like, I know the Benjamin.
Yeah. I couldn't put that in. I will say, I said $10 bill, the $50 bill. I can't, Grant is on the 50? I can't remember.
And I know, I've never seen
a 5-cent piece.
I'm just kidding.
You've never seen a 50.
I'm dropping Hamiltons.
I'm dropping Hamiltons all day long. You know when the... That's
what the Tooth Fairy brings these days.
Man, the Tooth Fairy brings...
I know. Well, I whatever's it. In your wallet. It's not... They can't wake up in the morning with nothing under there if you only have a tenner.
Good point. Good point. Have
Lucky
you ever
kid.
Have you ever gone to the ATM and gotten only tens? Like $100 in only tens? That happens in Bushwick.
Yeah. Like maybe once.
Aggravating. All right. Last question. What 90s food product commercial forever ingrained in our minds? Who shot Alexander Hamilton? Liz, can you play that clip?
And that was the Vienna Wood Dancing Bee, one of my all-time favorites. And now let's make that random call with today's $10,000 question. It's a tough one. Who shot Alexander Hamilton in that famous duel? All right, let's go to the phones and see who's out there.
Hello?
Hello, for $10,000, who shot...
Alan Buck.
Excuse me?
Alan Buck. Hold on, let me go for Buck.
All right, so basically it's a guy who's running the Aaron Burr, or the Alexander Hamilton Museum, and he's missing a certain 90s food product. Is it A, Mentos, the fresh maker? Is it B, pork, the other white meat, or is it C, got milk?
Yeah, milk.
It's milk. It's milk. Well done.
Because it was Aaron Burr and he'd eaten peanut butter.
Yeah, he ate a peanut butter sandwich.
Aaron Burr.
You did pretty well.
You did really well, Gabrielle. Absolutely. I encourage everyone to go out there and buy Gabrielle's cookbook, Prune.
I thought you were going to say milk.
Oh, get some milk too. I mean, with peanut butter, always must have.
We are not promoting milk here.
Gabrielle, do you have like a Twitter? Do you have Facebook, Pinterest, OKCupid? I don't know. All those things.
OKCupid.
I'm just kidding.
Are you comfortable with long radio silence? No, I do not. I'm sorry.
Well, just tell us maybe where we can get your cookbook.
At the bookstore. Probably through all possible outlets in the universe. And you can come to Prune or you can call me at Prune. I'd love to hear how it's going.
Great.
And what's going on in your life at Prune.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Chef. It was
Thanks for having me.
This is The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.